before you start, maybe you could give us a little preview of of the structure of this so that we can see if that's going to make some sense in terms of our trying to address all of the issues with the different defendants.
Sure, Your Honor. Kendra Matthews with Ransom Blackman on behalf of Mr. Anderson. I believe you have the case of Dr. Kirkham submitted on brief, so
yes.
There are three other co-defendants here. The co-defendants have agreed to rely on our briefs for independently raised assignments of error. Our intention was to discuss with the court the re-instruction of the jury after deliberations began for approximately 10 minutes or so, and I would be handling that discussion with the court. We would reserve the balance of the time for rebuttal argument with the caveat that if sentencing issues on cross-appeal are discussed with the court, that the co-defendants with cross-appeal sentencing issues may want to use some of that rebuttal time to address those issues. If not, then...
Well, they should assume that, at least from my standpoint, I'd like to hear a little bit about the sentencing
issue.
And
that is why we tried to divide it fairly equally, but because it was a cross-appeal issue, permit the government to argue first on sentencing.
Well, I'll say, I don't care if you address it now or on rebuttal. I'm interested in the conspiracy setup, multiple versus single, and... So if you don't address it, I'll ask the government, and so you need to have somebody prepared to address that, all right?
I think I'll anticipate addressing it on rebuttal argument, Your Honor.
All right. You may
give a little thought to it. The central argument that we believe the court should be reversing all convictions on, in this case for defendants, is that after a 25-day trial in which numerous issues were raised and 90 number of witnesses were called, the defendants were precluded from giving an effective closing argument and were effectively denied assistance of counsel in closing argument due to the reinstruction of the jury after about 12 hours of deliberation. The basis for those claims comes from both Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 30 and the Fifth and Sixth Amendment at the outset. The standards are very similar. The question for the court when there is a reinstruction after the defense counsel has been advised what the instructions will be, is whether or not the court can say that the court cannot conclude that closing was not impaired. And that involves a lot of negatives there, but I think that's the way the standard is phrased. If the court cannot conclude that closing was not impaired, then it should reverse the convictions. And that is certainly the case here. In terms of the statute of limitations issue, that was an issue that the trial court acknowledged was a major issue in the case. Many defendants moved to dismiss the case based on statute of limitations grounds, which on the indictment, which were denied. It was an issue that they were concerned about, certainly with some of the latter counts, count 6 and 7 for Mr. Anderson. The actual acts of evasion alleged were outside the statute of limitations. And in closing, the defendants had asked for statute of limitations instruction on all counts and were not given that instruction. Therefore, they structured their closing argument accordingly. A closing would make no sense making all sorts of references to dates when the jury would not be told that those dates would have any meaning. In the case law that you look at, particularly...
Can you just, being familiar with the case law, could you help us by giving us some specific example of what you were foreclosed from arguing because of the late introduction of the statute of limitations issue and the issue of overt acts?
Sure, Your Honor. I think... As a preliminary of that, and then I will get to an example, I think our fundamental argument would be that the defendants certainly would have retailored or restructured their closing arguments to at least address the concept of statute of limitations. and whether or not the items were pled in the indictment. The jury question itself at least provides an inference that the jury was seeking to look outside the indictment for overt acts. And
let me just get a factual question then.
Sure.
At least with respect to going beyond the 41 specified acts, was it not the case that the arguments covered some of the acts that went beyond the 41? That was included in the argument, was it not?
Well, I think that'll probably get to your first question as well, answering that. To what end were those issues addressed? The example, in fact, that the government used in hearing with the judge, I'm not sure if it was a telephone conference or in person, once the jury asked the question was, they said, Your Honor, the language of the indictment we now see permits us to have these acts. We would refer you to the Mitchums or the Mitchells. You can always get their names incorrect. Their testimony was in volume 12 of the transcript. And they said, Dr. Kirkham referred to the Mitchells in his closing argument. That would be an overt act that the jury could consider. In fact, Mr. Mitchell raised it in closing argument to say that's not a part of this case. In fact, there had been a limiting instruction to the jury saying, you're going to hear testimony on occasion that relates to only one defendant. These may be bad acts. We instruct you that if it relates to only one defendant, it goes to his state of mind. Keep that in mind with these two defendants. The judge did say, if you think evidence relating to CPA specifically can establish Dr. Kirkham's entry into the conspiracy, you could consider that. One of those acts, a number of those acts, but the only one really relating to CPA, took place in October 1994. That certainly wasn't addressed in anyone's closing argument. So there you have the Mitchell's testimony that in the midst of trial, people understood to be relating to Dr. Kirkham and his bad acts. And now, after the jury's been deliberating for 12 hours, you even have the prosecution, the government, saying, hey, you know, just off the top of my head, one overt act that they could use to convict all defendants would be the testimony relating to Dr. Kirkham and the Mitchells. So if you, understandably, over 25 days, while people and the jury is, we assume, rely on the instructions of the court, we have to be realistic in that. And that is why I think it goes back to not, can you show prejudice as to what specific things you would have argued, but was counsel given the opportunity to make a tactical decision about how to marshal the evidence?
Well, that's why I'm pursuing it, because if the standard, as you say, is cannot conclude that the closing was not impaired, that's not an abstraction, because always your closing would be restructured if you had a different instruction. I mean, almost by definition. So it really includes some notion of prejudice, and to understand that, it's helpful, at least from my standpoint, to try to understand pragmatically what difference it would have made. Because in some sense, to the extent that the statute of limitations hadn't been included, the jury certainly got that message in the re-instruction that you could only look to those that occurred post the 95 day.
Sure, and my point, I guess, with the Mitchums would be that they would have to be relied on their own memory to remember which acts that were not pled in the indictment occurred inside or outside.
Was that outside the statute of limitations?
Dr. Kirkham and the Mitchell's testimony, I believe the conduct was both in and outside, but the limiting instruction said that most of those bad acts were only to Dr. Kirkham. Even if you allow that, the act of introducing the Mitchells to CPA, the warehouse bank, was October 94 outside the statute of limitations. So that's my point in terms of making a tactical decision, and one that perhaps, yes, maybe Dorothy Flowers' attorney would have focused mostly on her conduct and restructured his closing argument to say, look at these acts that they claim are the closest tying her to the conspiracy. Look at how long ago they were. And, perhaps he wouldn't have addressed Dr. Kirkham, but there certainly was a tremendous amount of coordination. You can see throughout the case that they may have made a tactical decision to rely on someone else to make that argument so that the whole closing was effective in that regard. Getting back to the standard or the idea of prejudice, I do think, Your Honor, if you look at the case law, you have United States versus Parvill, 501 F2D 296, and that is cited in the briefs. In that case, there was a re-instruction, and the court said, wow, there's almost overwhelming evidence of guilt here. And the reference that the judge threw the defense attorney off on in closing was really quite brief in the closing. And they said, you know, in that context, even though it was nearly overwhelming and it was only a portion of the closing argument that was affected, we cannot say he wouldn't have retailored it to be effective. And, you know, that would be our argument on that end of the spectrum, that we're much closer to that. And certainly with issues like statute of limitations, you would have to change your approach. On the other end of the spectrum, you have, let me get the case name, Wyckoff, which is 545 FTT 679. That is really the only case in which this precise issue is raised and the Court of Appeals does not reverse. And in that instance, the judge actually added an element to the state's burden that the defendant had not produced any evidence on. So the court said, I'm not going to instruct that you have to show that you were incited to assault, I think. It was something related to that. I'm sure that's not precise. He had presented no evidence. The facts were that he had been sitting there and then suddenly in an assault. And the Ninth Circuit said there was nothing, no evidence that the defense attorney could have come up with, and therefore we can find no prejudice and we won't reverse. Here, I think that's not at all our situation. There was so much to work with.
What was the first case you mentioned before?
The first case was Parvill, 501 Parvill, and that is cited. Both of these cases are cited.
I know. I wasn't sure I was catching the name of the
case. Then on the overt acts, and we've obviously focused tonight, and I think the court's attention can focus on the closing argument aspect of the overt acts. But I did note that there was a case that was quite procedurally different, but United States versus Scherr, 794 F2D 903. And in that case, the judge had given an instruction identical to the instruction here, which was that the jury was told they had to find at least one of the overt acts listed in the indictment. And the court there said, had appellants known that they might have been convicted on the basis of acts not listed in the indictment, they might have sought to controvert those acts. The trial judge's instruction appeared to preclude that possibility, however, and therefore they did not argue that issue as they might have otherwise done. It is axiomatic that a person may not be convicted on the basis of acts that the parties have been told cannot support a conviction. Other than that quote, it was quite procedurally different, but I think that's exactly what happened here. They were first argued, we were told, you can only convict on the basis of the acts listed in the indictment. We argued the case, we did not address those other acts as overt acts in furtherance of the conspiracy. Then the judge re-instructed, and in fact, although it was axiomatic in the Third Circuit that couldn't be done, there's a possibility that a person was convicted on the basis of acts that the parties have been told could not support the conviction. And for that reason, we think that the conviction should be reversed. I'll reserve any other time.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Karen Quinnell, appearing on behalf of the United States. As to the statute of limitations issue, this case is not like Fuchs, where the court did not give the jury a statute of limitations instruction at all. Here, the district court gave the jury the statute of limitations instruction, albeit in the middle of jury deliberations. And therefore, the jury could reasonably have been expected to follow the court's instruction. Indeed, we must assume that the jury follows the instruction. The
question, right, but that doesn't solve the defendant's problem of course, the jury has to follow the instructions, but if you don't know what the instructions are, how do you make your argument to the jury on such a critical question?
Well, in this case, the question of whether or not an overt act took place on or before November 15th of 1994 is not a question that is complicated or confusing for the jury to decide. The jury does not need to have guidance by counsel say, don't forget, this act happened October 7, 1994, which is before November 15th, 1994, in the middle of jury deliberations, right when they were considering what overt act were they going to agree on. They were told by the court, you must find an overt act either listed in the indictment or substantially similar to those listed in the indictment that occurred after November 15th, 1994.
But if that's the case, just let me pursue this with you then. If the jury sends out a note and they've been told by the judge in the instruction that you can pick any out of a range of these overt acts, but you must unanimously agree on at least one, and the jury sends a note out and says, gee, can we go back, can we go outside the 41 overt acts? Doesn't that suggest that they may have been hung up on reaching agreement on the ones that were presented to them as part of the universe, be it overt acts and statute of limitations, and then let me finish my question. So that therefore, had the instruction been correct at the outset, and I know I'm blending overt acts and statute of limitations together, but that they would indicate that they were hung up, and therefore it was relevant to them to hear argument on why, if they couldn't agree on anything out of the 41 that was before them, have focused argument before they went in to deliberate, so that it would help them understand whether they should or shouldn't agree on the ones that they ultimately did. Now, we, of course, don't know whether they were looking to find multiple overt acts or they were zeroed in on one. I don't know what, obviously, we don't know that.
But correct. Well,
how does one tie that into the standard of how one structures one's closing argument?
The language of the indictment and the evidence at trial clearly put the defense on notice that the government was going to put on evidence and that the defendants would have to defend against evidence of overt acts other than the 41 listed in the indictment. For example, the indictment alleged that the co-conspirators committed overt acts, including but not limited to the following, and then listed some 41 types of acts or individual acts. For example, one category of acts is every time a deposit was made to CPA, or every time CPA wrote a check paying a client's mortgage insurance or utility bill. The jury instructions, the original jury instructions to the jury, informed them that they had to agree on an overt act as alleged in the indictment. As alleged in the indictment, the overt acts included but not limited to the following 41 acts. So the defendants knew from the language of the indictment and the evidence at trial they would be facing more than simply the 41 overt acts listed in the indictment. The court's instruction to the jury, which correctly stated the law, that you can consider overt acts not specifically listed in the indictment, merely clarified the court's original instruction that directed the jury to the specific language in the indictment that noted that the 41 listed acts were not exclusive.
Well, the jury picked up on the included but not limited to. That was the body of the note.
And they wanted clarification. They want to make sure. Can we agree on overt acts not specifically listed there because the indictment says, because it's not limited to? And the court properly informed the jury, yes. And in Franks, the court recognized that there is, of course, flexibility in proof because we can never expect a trial to be an exact replica of the information put before the grand jury or the language used in an indictment. And so long as the defendants are on notice of the core of criminality, the nature of the offense against which they must defend, it's okay for the jury to consider overt acts not specifically listed in the indictment. And here, there's no doubt that the defendants were on notice of the nature of the offense against which they had to defend. It was a decade-long conspiracy to obstruct.
Did the government, in closing, did you try the case? Were you?
I did not.
Okay. Did the government argue overt acts beyond 41 to the jury?
Specifically, I know that the government mentioned overt acts relating to a person, Lonnie Crockett, who came to the warehouse bank and used the warehouse bank for numbers of people. He was selling, he had his own scheme, he was selling trusts to people. And his clients would use CPA, two accounts in CPA, to send, one account would send money to an offshore entity. The other account at CPA would receive a wire transfer from the offshore entity, and that would be treated as a gift, so changing the character of their income. And the government addressed that particular area, which was not specifically alleged in the indictment, during closing argument. And defense counsel, specifically, I believe, defense counsel for Richard Flowers, addressed the Lonnie Crockett scheme.
Okay, I have one other question. I know Judge McKeon wants to ask about the conspiracy, but I would like to just, on the statute of limitations, a similar question. Did the government, in its argument, rely on overt acts that predated the November 1994?
Well, I do know, what I do recall from the closing argument is that the government and the defense both said, there's 41 overt acts listed in the indictment, you need to pick one of those. Right. So, by reference, obviously they
were
did.
Those all, and those were all post-dating November?
No. Some did and some did not.
So the answer is they did go back before the statute of limitations.
That's correct. They straddled the statute of limitations. Okay. And the way, although naturally we understand that this is certainly an unusual way to charge the jury on the statute of limitations, and we think that the court had every intention of giving the jury a statute of limitations instruction. For whatever reason, he didn't. He did give it to them during deliberations. The jury obviously, after reading that, focused their attention on the dates of the overt acts that they were looking at. So I think that it's clear beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendants could not have been convicted by this jury under the instructions the jury had on some overt act that took place before November 15th, 1994.
Do they have the dates in front of them?
The jury? You mean the date for the statute of limitations?
No, or yes, the dates of and the dates of the overt
act. Yes, they did. In the court gave both oral and written supplemental instructions, and right in there, several times, it said the overt act or affirmative act of evasion must have occurred after November 15th, 1994.
But I'm wondering if they knew or had before them when the overt acts occurred.
Well, as to the 41 listed overt acts, they certainly had those dates. The jury in this case was taking notes. So perhaps they were taking notes on the dates. Obviously, the jury's recollection of when an event occurred would control. And in addition to that, there are perhaps hundreds, perhaps thousands of overt acts that took place.
Wouldn't that substantiate the argument that the defense has that Here there are 41 acts, and then there are others that were argued, and the jury would not know, unless they took really good notes, what date that was, but that would be the sort of thing that would be pointed out at argument.
That is a thing that the defense could have pointed out, you know, don't forget, these acts took place a long time ago, they took place at a certain
time.
Well,
they took, you can't consider them because they took place before the statute.
Well, you can't consider them as an overt act, as an overt act satisfying
that's
them.
Right.
That's
so
correct.
That would be kind of an important thing for the defense to be able to point out, wouldn't it? Because it's a lot to expect the jury to remember the dates of all of the overt acts.
Yes, but we expect the jury to remember all kinds of things, and we do know that they were taking notes, and we do know that they were focused by the court's instructions
and
on the timing.
And we expect the defense attorneys to have an opportunity to make an oral argument to point those things out.
That's correct. The defense did not bring to the court's attention prior to the court. The defendants could have objected after the court instructed the jury and said, we want to reopen closing argument and make an argument about the timing of events. They never brought this to the court's attention. So the issue before this court is, was it plain error to give the statute of limitations instruction during deliberations, when the timing of an event is a straightforward...
Or was it plain error not to allow them to argue? I think
well, the court did not refuse to allow them to argue it.
There was nothing the matter with giving the instruction. That was correct.
Right.
So the question is whether it was plain error for the judge not to allow them to argue.
The district court did not refuse to allow them to raise the statute of limitations argument. They did not attempt during their closing argument to raise that. The reason they claim that they were precluded from that is that the court's proposed instructions did not include a statute of limitations instruction. But they didn't stand up before the court read them and say, Your Honor, statute of limitations is vital to our case. We can't argue statute of limitations if you won't give a statute of limitations instruction.
I'm talking about after he had made the additional instruction.
Uh-huh.
That's the time that I believe the defense is contending that they should have had an opportunity to argue.
Well, I suppose they could have asked to reopen closing argument then.
But they didn't do so. You're saying so they waived any objection on that ground?
I don't believe
that
they
requested.
It would have
to be plain error for the court not to have
sua sponte ordered. And it seems to me that it's not. It is a pretty straightforward question. When did something happen? And there was so much evidence that this conspiracy was ongoing until virtually the time of the indictment, that it defies belief to think that the jury picked an overt act that occurred in 1987 as opposed to one that occurred after 1994.
Let me ask you about the conspiracy of the single versus multiple conspiracy. And
excuse me, could I just ask one question?
Sure, yeah, finish
you up said, on did they have the indictment before them?
The jury?
Yeah.
Yes, they did.
Well, because the indictment lists the overt acts in the indictment.
Yes, they're listed.
I mean, and their dates.
There are dates.
They're all dated.
There are other overt acts.
Yes, that came in. So that gets into the other issue.
Exactly.
Okay, fine. Sorry, I just wanted to...
No, that's fine. It's fine. We want to make sure we've exhausted...
You can always come back if you think of something. I'm here.
Why, thank you.
The multiple conspiracy issue and versus single.
Yes.
One thing that I'm curious about with respect to the government's theory is that the mere membership in the CPA was in fact illegal and part of this conspiracy.
Is your question was mere membership of CPA?
Right. Was that the criminal act?
No.
Okay.
No. The jury was instructed, well, first of all, the indictment charged that the co-conspirators, those listed and certain unnamed conspirators, participated in using CPA to defraud the United States by preventing the government from being able to determine who had income and what income was assigned to which member, which client of CPA. The jury instructions instructed the jury that they needed to find, among several other things, that the defendants willfully agreed to engage in the conspiracy that was alleged in the indictment, that being a broad conspiracy to use commingling of funds, false names, false social security numbers, phony trusts, writing checks.
And you need that agreement for each defendant, correct?
That's correct. And on at more than one occasion, the court said, you must find that the defendants agreed to participate in the plan alleged in the indictment.
Okay, so one of my questions is why isn't each of the defendants, in effect, signed up to that agreement? How are they joined?
Well, they're joined. Are you speaking of a rim sort of thing?
Well, if there is that.
If you want to use that as the joinder.
Well, I wouldn't say that so derisively. That comes from the United States Supreme Court, so I didn't dream it up.
No, of course not. Many courts have said, you know, we just look to see whether there was one overall agreement, and that's what you look at. What was the overall agreement? That is how they are joined. They're joined by the overall agreement to join together, to use their numbers to defraud the United States, to prevent the United States from finding out who has money.
All the other people in this CPA are unindicted co-conspirators?
Well, naturally not all of them, because, of course, as to prove anyone is involved in a conspiracy, we need to prove appropriate intent. And as to all of the defendants that were charged, we proved the appropriate intent. For example, Mr. Kirkham, he was recruiting people, all kinds of people, to come in and use CPA. Look, it's totally safe. Your money will be safe there. You can hide the fact that you're making money from your business. Mr. Anderson was using the services of CPA for almost a decade. He would change the name of his business so that it would be Commercial Printing and Art, so that all checks he received could be payable to CPA, so that when they were commingled with the other account holders, it would be even easier, it would be even harder for the government, if they ever figured out what was going on, to trace. Because if you have 10, 20, 30, 100 people running businesses, all having their checks paid to CPA, how can we figure out that that check to CPA is John Anderson, is a payment to John Anderson?
I guess that, to be more precise then, you're not saying that warehouse banking in and of itself is illegal.
No.
But that these particular individuals in their use of warehouse banking showed the requisite intent
that
along
is
with the agreement.
Okay.
So the mere fact that they advertised it as a program by which the funds would, in effect, be commingled and that it would assure privacy and hide the paper trails so the IRS couldn't track it down, you're saying that that alone was not sufficient?
Well, that certainly
so
gives
that anybody who joined CPA would, in essence, be by that act alone guilty of a conspiracy?
By merely joining CPA?
Yeah.
I don't believe they would. I mean, that certainly gives an explanation of what their whole thing is about. But if you, I believe you're referring to Government Exhibit 45.
Mm-hmm.
And if you take a look at that, it does refer to other kinds of things. So I believe that it's possible, I don't know if it really happened, but it's possible that someone could have used CPA because they wanted to buy gold.
Well, some significant number of people paid their taxes.
And some people did pay their taxes.
Yeah, not an insignificant number.
You know, we're not saying that those people conspired to defraud the government. If the defendants, or if a hypothetical defendant, joined in CPA, knowing about what they were going to do, knowing the whole thing, and at the end of the year, he filled out his tax return and mailed it in, we certainly couldn't say that person was evading their taxes or preventing the government from finding out what kind of income he had. So it all depends on how you use it, if you're an individual account holder. And as for the people that were operating it, I mean, we know they were operating this specifically for at least this purpose. Maybe more purposes. Maybe they really wanted to, you know, purchase gold or whatever. But at least one of their purposes was to impair and impede the Internal Revenue Service in the carrying on of its proper functions.
Okay. Could I ask you, if there aren't questions on the conspiracy, on the sentencing, the court relied on 3584.
That's correct.
So assuming that in order to avoid the consecutive sentences, that was appropriate. What more did the district court have to do, in your view, to justify the downward, in effect, a downward departure?
Well, first of all, the district court, if you look at the district court's findings of fact, which I have back on my desk, but you can see that the district court, excuse me, specifically says, I am denying.
Have some
Sorry,
water.
Your Honor. Water.
Take your time. We're here all day. But it's your clock that's
like
running.
Me. The court specifically says, I am denying. I'm very sorry I have a cold.
No, that's all right.
I'm denying Richard Flowers' motion for a downward departure. The court said, in the middle of sentencing, I'm informing. Oh, I'm sorry.
Take your time.
Take your time and
drink.
Start over.
It may be gone.
Maybe. Why don't you yield to the other side and recover your voice? So.
Thank you.
And then we'll talk.
Come back on sentencing on that issue.
No, that's fine.
Why don't you address the anything you want to address on the conspiracy or on the re-instruction?
Thank you, Your Honor. Briefly on the multiple conspiracy issue, at least from our Mr. Anderson's part, we're content to rely on the briefs, although we do think our brief outlines that in Mr. Anderson's case in particular, he was acting at most on his own in a conspiracy for himself, would be the, as outlined in our argument. That would be our argument on multiple conspiracies. Turning to some of the statements that were made regarding the statute of limitations issue, I guess the first issue would be preservation. The trial court itself found that the statute of limitations request was preserved. The court noted, and I think this is outlined extensively in our reply brief and as well as a number of other reply briefs, that there it wasn't inadvertence that the court did not give a statute of limitations instruction. He was aware defendants wanted it. He was relying on the government to provide him with all of the instructions that were appropriate. Defendants also sought a special verdict form, in which case the overt act would have been identified and may have resolved these issues. That was not used. The court made it very clear at the hearings that he was giving a conscientious review to everything submitted, and he wanted the most precise make-your-record sort of thing, which I know district courts sometimes do, not completely understanding the preservation issue, but he did subsequently say this issue was preserved. There's no question.
So what I'm trying to understand, so you go into the argument thinking it's an unlimited universe of overt acts and time and argue, therefore, all that you think are important. As Judge Hugg's question suggested then, had there been a November 94 cutoff date, what would have been better for your argument then? As it is, you got a chance to address them all. So what is it that the cutoff date would have done other than say, and by the way, these overt acts or these acts that are being talked about by the government are pre-November 94, so you can't rely on that.
I'm not sure if I understand the scope of your question. When the defendants requested a statute of limitations instruction, mm-hmm. and in fact reviewed an instruction that said you are limited to the acts outlined in the indictment, which I will get back to, that is how the defendants framed their argument. They then did the closing, as we discussed previously. They didn't even structure it to discuss time frame. There would have been no purpose. The jury would have had that would have meant nothing to the jury. So it's our contention that it was, you know, the argument was not framed properly at the time.
But
the
what would be the difference in the argument other than to say they can't rely on those overt acts because they're pre-94?
Certainly, for the acts in the that were pled in the indictment, they could have pointed out the different acts that were pre and post. But also they could have pointed out whether the overt acts that were in the indictment that were appropriately timed were in furtherance of the indictment. And maybe there was a stronger argument that those were not in furtherance of the indictment. And maybe the arguments wouldn't have been able to quickly disregard the ones outside the statute of limitations and focus their arguments on the ones that were inside. Here you go beyond that because you're not just looking at the indictment. You're looking at the whole scope of the trial. Much of that evidence was introduced for different purposes, and the government is entitled to introduce evidence of agreement. And in fact, during the closing argument, the only references that were made to these other acts were relating to agreement. Not to whether or not it was an overt act in furtherance of the government. Everyone clearly.
Well, what happens then at trial? Jury goes back, note comes out, new instruction is given. At that point, the defense doesn't ask for additional or supplemental argument. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. And at that point, the jury had been deliberating for 12 hours or so. They had perhaps an overt act specifically in their mind, perhaps not. It was too late for defendants to certainly on the fly, structure an argument that would say, okay, now we know you're going to consider the whole world of overt acts, and we don't know what you're thinking, but we'd like to say, don't think about this issue from day two of the trial. Don't think about these issues. It would have been nearly impossible to do that. The judge gave the parties a half an hour to come back with their agreement and then overnight to instruct the jury. And he said, you know, they're deliberating. I've stopped them from deliberating. I want to continue with this process.
But you had overnight?
That's true.
I guess I'm just, you know, we're in a situation where you're saying the argument would have been different. And maybe what you're really saying is that there's no way to recoup it. You don't think that supplemental argument
absolutely
would have been ineffective, but it would have been a partial remedy to your concern.
I don't think it would have been a partial remedy to our concern, although obviously if given the opportunity we would have done it. We still would be before this court if there had been a conviction, arguing that that is no way for the Sixth Amendment to operate in terms of counsel making argument.
Let me ask you about the
can I just
the
have
timing.
A follow
I just want to finish that, though, on the timing of this. You asked for a statute of limitations instruction. Did the judge affirmatively tell you he's not going to give it, or did it just not show up when he gives you the court's proposed instructions?
Well, the way the trial operated, statute of limitations was raised as a motion at the beginning.
Right.
It was argued throughout, and then it was submitted as instructions under Rule 30, submitted instructions. Then the judge said, you know, I've reviewed everyone's instructions. Please let me know anything you specifically want me to look at. And we did draw the court's attention. And we did draw the court's attention specifically to the statute of limitations instruction, and said to the court, you know, please take a look at instruction number 29. We want you to look at it. Then the judge took the instructions provided by both parties, came back, and I think I outlined in the reply brief, essentially adopted the government's instructions and said, you know, here's what I'm going to do. Here's what I've decided to do.
At the time, was there an objection to not giving?
I believe at the time that at that point, it would be in the briefs, Your Honor, and I just don't want to misstate the record.
All right.
It would be in the reviewability section of exactly the procedure. I'm not sure that he did. It's crucial to note, of course, that when it was done, the judge made it clear that he was conscious, and that's really the purpose of preservation, to give the trial court the opportunity to make the right decision. The judge made it clear in an order that is in our supplemental excerpt of records, defendants preserve this issue. So whether you would want to go under Kessie and the would it be futile to make a further objection if there wasn't one at the appropriate time immediately before argument, or if you simply want to say it was preserved, either way, it's not a plain error standard because the judge made it clear that he was aware and that he had decided not to give it.
Could I pursue? You answered in response talking about this statute of limitations, how it would affect the argument. You said, well, some of these acts were put in for other purposes. Does that relate to the statute of limitations issue or to going beyond the 41?
It's a difficult time idea for me conceptually, Your Honor, to keep them both out. I would say if you stay within the indictment, then our argument would be that, you know, those statute of limitations issues are all outlined and the evidence admitted to them was direct. So you only get to the statute of limitations concern, really a broad concern, once you go outside the...
Right. So they're really intertwined.
They're really tied.
Because the indictment does specify when the acts, they had that in front of them. They didn't have to have any of you or notes, because the indictment lays out the chronology. So if
certainly,
there's a cutoff, they can say, we can't look at this.
Certainly our argument, yeah. Although we would argue we'd
okay.
like to restructure, but you're right.
All right, that's just what I wanted to get clarified.
And, Your Honor, I'm way beyond time.
That's fine.
Are there any questions regarding a certain particular defendant's sentence?
No, although we're going to let the government make an argument on sentencing, and then we're going to give you all an appropriate opportunity to respond. I think this was in response to your question.
Yeah.
Thank you.
We're talking about Mr. Flowers.
Judge Fischer, would you like me to address the question you were trying to ask me?
Yes. My question was, what, A, was it proper, do you agree that it's proper for the district court to resort to 3584? And if so, what did he fail to do in order to justify?
Okay. First of all, it was improper for him to resort to 3584. He specifically said in his finding of fact order on page 5, the court acknowledged that it had discretion to consider defendant Richard Flowers' motion for departure, but declined to do so in his case. As to 3584, he says, I always retain discretion to impose concurrent or consecutive sentences whenever I determine what the appropriate total punishment should be. Accordingly, during the sentencing hearing, the government at the court for the first time informed the government, I'm going to impose concurrent rather than consecutive sentences on Richard Flowers. The government had no idea that the court was contemplating a downward departure. The government objected on the basis of 5G1.2, which requires, in situations such as this, when the lower part of the guideline exceeds the total statutory maximum available on the count with the highest statutory maximum, that sentences must run consecutive to equal the total punishment. So the government objected on that ground. The district court rejected that, saying, I assume I have discretion to impose the sentence concurrently, and that's what I'm going to do. If the government had known that the court was contemplating a departure, which is the only way he can impose the sentence that he imposed under Pedrioli and Williams, cases in this court, the government could have marshaled evidence, gotten together evidence of sentences nationwide in cases involving decade-long...
I understand what... Okay. All right. That's answering part of my question, but you said it was improper for him to go to 3584 at all. You're saying he's foreclosed from doing that, that he doesn't have discretion to do that?
Well, not in the Ninth Circuit. In the Ninth Circuit, under Pedro
Williams,
the Ninth
Circuit,
he can impose those sentences if he downward departs.
Fine. Okay. And so what he failed to do was follow
the normal downward departure procedures.
Right.
Didn't find
okay.
The case was outside the heartland,
yeah,
didn't
fine.
Give the government notice.
All right.
Thank you.
And since the...
And he tied the other two to the Flowers.
Exactly.
It's in your brain.
That's laid out pretty clearly.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your courtesies, Your Honor.
Okay. We're your very Honor. Courteous to people from Washington, even in the Ninth Circuit.
All right. Thank you.
Why don't you respond on the Flowers? We recognize that there, I guess, three other defendants would potentially would flow from an answer to that, but if you could respond on that point, it would be helpful.
Good morning, Your Honor. Chris Weinmiller for Richard Flowers. Your Honor, on the issue of the downward departure that the court granted, I think that it's true that none of us were recognizing at the time that that, in effect, constituted a downward departure in the circuit. I do think, though, that the procedures that Judge King followed were adequate under the law here. The two cases that the government just cited, the Pedrioli and the Williams case, were both cases in which the district court decided to impose consecutive terms, despite the fact that the guidelines would have called for a sentence within the maximum of the primary offense. In other words, the guidelines would have suggested that concurrent terms were appropriate, and the district court wanted to impose a greater sentence given upward departure. And so I think that the emphasis that this court places on the need for notice ahead of time really has to do with the defendant's due process right to know what he's facing. And I would suggest that because in this situation, the court was considering, ended up giving downward departure to Mr. Flowers, that notice issue is less important than it was in Pedrioli and Williams. I would also point the court to the sentencing memoranda and the sentencing letter, which is contained, I believe, in the pre-sentence report. It's appended to the pre-sentence report that the government just recently filed under seal. It's clear in both of those documents that, in fact, Defendant Flowers was asking the court to impose concurrent sentences. Again, it wasn't referred to in the context of a downward departure, but it was obvious that that was an issue that the government needed to respond to at sentencing. And lastly, when the government...
Can I just understand, then? You're saying that assuming that in order to avoid the guideline sentence... then the court had to resort to 3584. You're saying that we should read Pedrioli and Williams as simply applying to upward departures, in effect going to consecutive over concurrent, but if it's a downward, then it's really boils down to nothing more than a question of notice, and the reasons that the court gave here
were
adequate?
The court would still have to make the appropriate findings, and I think the court here did. The Das case, which is also cited in the briefs, 198 Fed 3rd 1167, it's a 1999 case from the circuit, indicates that a proper basis for a downward departure can be sentencing disparity. And the district court in this case specifically cited sentencing disparity in similar cases. I think he used the term as tax protester cases that have been heard within the District of Oregon as a basis for determining that imposing a sentence of more than 5 years on Mr. Flowers would be excessive. He made reference to the fact that his research indicated that the longest such sentence in the district prior to Mr. Flowers' sentencing had been 30 months. And after evaluating the facts and circumstances of this particular case, decided that going above 30 months to 60 months was more than sufficient, and then beyond that would be an inappropriate disparity from the other case.
What about the government says, well, we weren't on notice that this really was a departure, so we weren't able to respond appropriately.
Well, they were on notice that Mr. Flowers was seeking a concurrent sentence. There's no question about that. And the point, really, that I was making earlier about...
Well, I guess I'm just asking in response to their point. They were on notice about that, but they say that they view that under the statutory authority to go concurrent versus consecutive as opposed to whether you evaluate it under a downward departure. So they didn't really respond in the same... It's like people were talking like this in their view. I mean, is that... Do you think that... I guess what you're asking us to do is to say... There's enough there to support what the district court did for it to not be an abuse.
I am saying exactly that I believe that the court made findings that are sufficient to support what, in effect, was a downward departure, and that the government was on notice that that sentence was being considered. If the government did not recognize that, in effect, in this circuit constitutes a downward departure, that was their error. They did not ask the court to make more specific findings. They didn't object on that basis. And the court, I think, was well within its rights and exercising its discretion to impose concurrent sentences. But is the court interested in having me address any of the other issues?
No, I think there's no other specific questions, and the government didn't raise any, so... If you've concluded on the consecutive concurrent issue, then we'll deem the case submitted. Thank you. In case of United States versus Anderson is submitted. We will also submit on the briefs this morning Flowers versus Hall, and Earl X versus Morrow has been removed from the calendar. Thank you to all counsel, and we'll adjourn for this morning.
All rise. The court for this session stands adjourned.